From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Pete Docter, one of the directors with Pixar Animation Studios, says if a character is going to work, people have to relate to it, which is something of a trick because many of the characters in Pixar films are, well, not exactly real. They're toys and robots and monsters. The way in, says Docter, is the story. And all successful stories have an emotional hook that we connect to. Fear or longing or loss. Docter directs the latest Pixar film. It opens next month. It's called Up. It's the story of Carl Fredrickson, a 78-year-old balloon salesman who's lost his wife and his sense of purpose until he embarks on a fantastic voyage. Pete Docter is in Utah this week. Today in the program, he's joining us in studio to talk about the art of storytelling in animation, how you make people care about an image drawn on a screen. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Making an animated film work seems like a balancing act. The characters don't have to be human or even real, but they do have to be believable. So we'll go along with a robot with emotions or a talking toy, but we have to care about them. Take the latest animated film from Pixar Studios. It's called Up, and it's the story of Carl Fredrickson, a 78-year-old balloon salesman who embarks on a fantastic adventure by tying thousands of balloons to his house and sailing away into the sky. We care about Carl because he's experienced loss, and he's also looking for a friend. The director of the film is Pete Docter, and he's in Utah this week. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the art of storytelling and about the journey of his own professional life. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Pete Docter joined Pixar in 1990. He's worked on a number of projects, including as supervising animator for Toy Story, wrote and directed Monsters Incorporated, and along with co-writers Andrew Stanton and Jim Reardon, he was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay for last year's hit WALL-E. His latest film, Up, as we mentioned, opens nationwide on May 29th. And Pete Docter, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by, you grew up in Minnesota.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you envision yourself, I don't know, becoming or doing? I mean, was it related to art always?
Well, sort of a offshoot of art. I mean, I took art classes at school and stuff, but didn't really have a good time. Huh. I liked just doing drawings in the corners of my math books. And, you know, there was always the guy in class who was drawing all the time.
Yeah.
That was not me.
That wasn't you.
It wasn't me. But and in fact, I always felt very intimidated by people who could draw really well, and I felt inadequate there. But as soon as I could figure out you can flip through the drawings and make them move, I was hooked.
Huh.
Making it come alive, that's what it's all about. And that's why I loved puppetry and computer animation, same thing. I don't have to draw. I can use a computer. But I still get to bring these characters to life. And there's something magical to me about this idea that one half of your brain knows this is just fake. This is all right. Artifice. And the other half is crying or laughing.
Yeah.
You know, and that idea of when you can do that, that's really, really pleasing.
You know, I read that you had taken you took some art classes in college, but you also took a lot of philosophy classes.
Yeah.
So what was that about? And were you working out stories and emotions and things like that even then?
I guess so. This was at the University of Minnesota before I kind of figured out that you could make a living doing animated films.
Yeah.
And they just appealed to me, you know, the sort of thought exercises. And so, yeah.
I want to both your parents were doctors. Is that right?
Well, my father, he has a PhD in musicology.
Got it.
And my mother is a teacher of music as well. So a lot of music running around in the family.
And you play music?
I have, yeah. And my sister actually played with the Utah Symphony for a while.
She's right?
She's a cellist now with the Met in New York. So
what's the relationship? Is there between was there a lot of art, you know, a lot of must have been a lot of creativity at home, right?
Yeah, it was fun. And I think there's definitely a connection between music and animation. They're both temporal things. You know, I almost hear something in my head before I see it, you know, before I visualize it.
Huh.
And when I was animating a lot, I would time things out by music. And, I, you know, I, of course, grew up with Carl Stalling and did all the Warner Brothers shorts. And so I kind of hear those sort of music cues in my head. So
I read about one of your influences was I think it was The Muppet Show was kind of influential.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
In what way?
I just love the sense of goofiness and off-the-wall kind of comedy. But at the heart of it all was – and I could had a sense of this even when I was pretty young – is that it was all character. Like Fozzie – if you look at the jokes that Fozzie the Bear tells, they're awful. Like nobody would get laughs with that stuff.
Right.
And they take advantage of that and use the fact that he's a failing comedian. And suddenly you feel for him. You feel pathos. You laugh at his jokes in spite of how awful they are. And I mean, that's what we're trying to do too, is just create these really rich, deep characters that you believe, that you know almost more deeply than your own friends, you know? I think that's what – when you go see a movie or you watch something on television and you really get to know these characters, that's very satisfying for an audience.
You know, there's a moment in, and we'll talk more about Up as we go along. We'll sort of lay out the plot a little bit more. But there is this moment early on in the film. I don't want to give anything away, but where Carl – what can we say about Carl meeting Ellie? Can we talk much about that?
Sure.
Okay. I don't want to give too much away. But Carl Fredrickson as a young boy meets – this adventurous young tomboy, Ellie.
Yeah.
And he meets her, and there's this moment in this rickety old house where she grabs him by the hand and sort of pulls him upstairs to find the spoon that he's lost.
Yeah.
But there's this kind of lag. There's this moment. And I'm wondering how much thought you put into those kinds of – because it was such a subtle moment and it goes by fairly quickly. But there's this moment, it's kind of a – it stops for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, talk about those kinds of moments, how important they are, because I sort of see them throughout your films.
Well, we try to build up a contrast. And I think in some ways it kind of goes back to the rule of threes joke telling kind of thing where you set up – what's the middle one? I forgot what they call it. And then you pay it off.
Yeah,
and so you set up this rhythm that you're going along and then you break it.
Yeah.
And you just find these moments to stop. And that allows the audience to pay attention. You're focusing them very deliberately when you do that sort of thing. And that was a moment we felt that was important, that he's really connecting with this girl and he's seeing something that he doesn't have and vice versa. And it's kind of the moment they fall in love in a very subtle way. So –
and then he yanks her out off. She yanks him off.
Yep.
That's the payoff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
How would you describe the difference, Pete Docter, between computer animation and conventional animation? I mean, beyond the obvious, is there a difference?
I think there is. It's interesting you ask that because I've been thinking about that. Hand-drawn animation, I think, is almost more reductive. It strips away.
Yeah.
You can like the great caricaturist Al Hirschfeld, right? You look at his drawings and he captures a likeness of a person in just a few deft lines, almost more like them than a photograph or, you know. And animation, hand-drawn animation has the power to do that. It's also something where you really feel the hand of the artist. Whereas computer animation is more about lush detail, lighting cues. It's about adding well, it's still kind of subtracting. It's still boiling down from real life.
Right.
But I think the strength that we've tried to lean on are things like textures and surfaces that are so believable. You get these reflections and refraction through glass and all the things that we're used to seeing in real life that we're able to kind of caricature a little bit and almost make them hyper real.
Yeah.
You know?
They're stylized, I guess.
Yeah. And we've especially tried to do that on this film. You know, whereas in most films, well, if you take a measurement of us and measure us by head size, we're about 7 heads tall.
Right.
Carl is about 3. You know, he's a very stylized, stocky, squared off kind of guy. And that kind of sets the tone for the rest of the film. I mean, this is a movie where a house flies into the air with thousands of balloons tied to the roof.
Yeah.
So we knew we needed to stylize a certain amount and we tried to push that.
The caricature, he is – one thing you notice in his – he's squared off. I mean almost everything about his body, Carl, is squared off. I mean if you look at his fingers, they're blocks.
Right.
Very, very angular. What's important about the idea of this, of the square, the angle?
Well, everything comes from the inside. So as we're developing the character, we realize, okay, this guy is stuck. He is self-limited. You know, as soon as his wife, he loses his wife, which happens pretty early on in the film, he now is stuck within this little house. And so everything – that just felt like a square. You know, everything is represented that way, whereas she has been swirls and circles and he's just this square block. And it's not until later that he's sort of drawn out of that. So we were trying to visually represent kind of the internal of everybody, you know, in the design, yeah, in the lighting. We tried to keep him in shadow a lot until later then he comes out into the light. So there's all these kind of storytelling devices that you use to try to strengthen the emotional storytelling of what's going on.
I think that somebody had said, I was reading about it, that Carl was the most caricatured thing that you've, if not ever done, you've done in a long time at Pixar. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's sort of subjective, but yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, it's, and it was, again, kind of because of the story that we knew we needed that, as well as just I think that's kind of where my tastes run.
Yeah.
So
what was the reaction to – because in some ways it's a departure, I guess it could be said, to take something so stylized, because if it's so about a lot of the pieces in the past have been so about realism, and now you're sort of stripping it away with caricature. What was the reaction that you were getting? Were people worried about that? And what exactly was the look that you were coming up with, that you wanted to create with that?
We wanted to and again, it all goes back to story. We wanted to have this sense of smallness to Carl's world, that he lives in what almost feels like a dollhouse. So we made a deliberate effort, and it took a lot of work and a lot of working with the technical folks to stylize things, even like the thickness of cloth. You know, Carl has this jacket, and if you look at it on him and you measure that, it's about an inch and a half thick, which is completely preposterous,
right?
But you buy it in this world.
Yeah.
You know? And the things like the surfaces never end at right angles. They always have a little bit of a roundedness. Again, trying to feel like it's a small, intimate kind of space. And then you contrast that with where he goes in the film, and it's this vast expanse where, you know, you can feel the wind in your face and smell, and it's hopefully very tactile and real. And so you have these two extremes within the story, and trying to balance the both of those. But, you know, it was – it was not easy. There was definitely some, as we were approaching it, some nervousness from some folks. But, you know, that's the great thing about Pixar, is that everybody always wants to push it. If we've done it before, we don't want to do it again.
Right.
You know, you want to keep – that's what keeps us all there, is that sense of doing something new and constantly kind of pushing the boundaries. And you know, we look at this as a medium, not a genre.
Right.
It's not – it doesn't have to fit in this little box. Animation could do anything.
Yeah.
You could tell a slasher film or a anything. Action adventure, that's what this is.
Yeah.
You know? So
you, I think I read somewhere where you had liked – one of the things that you liked, I guess, early on was the Walt Disney film Dumbo.
Yeah.
Something simple about it.
Yeah.
Did that influence your take on Carl in some way?
Well, definitely. And you look at that film and you know, this is at the beginning of the film where the storks are delivering babies down to the zoo.
Yeah.
And they fly down and there is literally the state of Florida with the word Florida across it, right?
Right?
And this train and stuff, and it's so caricatured and stylized. And then they go down, they land, and they deliver babies, and you just go with it.
Yeah.
So I knew that, you know, people are willing to believe that a sock with ping pong balls on it is alive,
yeah,
right? That's
yeah,
just our – it's kind of our inherent makeup, is that we want to see personality in things. I remember when I was a little kid, I spent $5 on something and I cried because I thought the $5 bill would be lonely, you know.
But wow.
I had that sort of sense of everything is alive. So I don't know whether that informed what I'm doing now or what. But,
you know, I'm sure there were a lot of people who were enchanted by that film, The Polar Express. But there were some who were kind of creeped out at the ways some of those images looked, and I think it was because they were too real or something. For Pixar, there are all kinds of different looks, but what's the trick? What's the balance between the realistic and the fantastic? Is there
Well, there's a really interesting study that's been done, and basically the words I'm leading to are the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
So if you start with a circle and two dots on one end of a spectrum, people relate somewhat. They, you know, even babies, I remember we had all these shapes, squares and circles and things, and we had this one of a circle with two dots and a line. My son, as an infant, would just stare at that one. You know, all the rest he would kind of look at, but that was the one he stared at because that's just the way we're programmed, right?
Yeah.
But then as you add more details, nose and eyebrows, people bond even closer and more to those images. And they get closer and closer as it approaches photorealism. But right before it does, connection from a viewer dips down way even below the circle with two dots.
Huh.
And it's because I think if you get too close – but you don't quite get it right, people know, ugh, something wrong.
Yeah.
You know, when we all spend all day, every day, staring at other people and trying to read their expressions and is this person think I'm an idiot? Are they getting what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, all that kind of thing. And so we're pretty good at recognizing those little nuances. So we're trying to stay to the circle and two dots side of that uncanny valley. You know, we're definitely even on Toy Story, which I look back on and I think a lot of the humans are not very successful by today's standards. But even there, we were trying to stylize and caricature as much as we could.
Pete Docter is with us. He's the writer and director of Pixar's latest film called Up, which opens around the country on May 29th. We invite you to join the conversation if you like with questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a reason the animated films from Pixar are so successful, but it's probably complicated. The characters, like a cowboy, a doll, or a robot trash compactor, are decidedly unreal, but if they're going to work, they have to be believable, even tangible. And then there are the stories, probably the real secret. Today on the program, Pixar writer and director Pete Docter is with us in studio. He's in Utah this week. Docter helped create last year's hit WALL-E. We're talking about his latest film. It's called Up, and it opens next month. It's about a 78-year-old balloon salesman who sets out to fulfill his lifelong dream of adventure. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Doctor, I wanted to ask you about when you first came to Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
You were, I think, the third animator brought on board.
Yeah.
So it was 1990, early on, very early on.
Mm-hmm.
What was the culture like? I mean, what was it like there at Pixar then? What were the ideas that were bouncing about then?
Well, it was kind of a strange time. Now, looking back, a lot of people have said, oh, we were leading up to this momentous thing of doing the first feature animated film. But at the time I started, it didn't seem like that at all. They had a medical imaging group. They were making hardware. The 2 weeks after I started, Steve Jobs showed up to lay off half the company.
Wow.
So I kind of thought, geez, did I did I go the right way here?
Right.
You know, but then we were doing commercials. So the commercial group was a small little subsection of the whole company. And commercials were kind of like, you know, you hear the old Disney animators talk about the short films as their training ground. That's where they really developed their chops. And I think the commercials were that to us. We had these definite restrictions of things you had to show. You couldn't go over 30 seconds, not a frame, more or less.
Right.
And yet we wanted to tell these stories even with the commercials. And so it was really good training for us. So, but it was, I mean, back to your original question, it was kind of like I equate it to when Toy Story came out. It was almost like we were a bunch of guys doing this for fun in our garage.
Yeah.
And it shocked me to see that everybody else not only knew about it but liked it. You know, it was really shocking because it did have that sort of small, we're just doing this for fun kind of feel. And hopefully we've maintained that at least to some degree.
Is that the idea, is to try to maintain – even though you've grown and you're wildly successful, the idea is to keep it kind of intimate and
– oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, if – if you're not emotionally invested in what you're doing, then change it. You know, that's what we try to – like, I don't want to work on anything that I can't live, breathe, and sleep for 5 years, because that's what it's going to take.
That's what it took 5 years.
Yeah. Uh-huh. A long time.
Yeah. Well, tell about, if you would, the road trips. I've read about these road trips that you take, apparently take with your family. And I'm wondering if when you're going, is it just about the adventure with the family, or are you do you find yourself, whether you're consciously doing it or not, making sketches or writing down ideas, making note of, you know, names and faces and circumstances? Is that what it's like on a road trip with you?
Yeah. I mean, it's and this is actually – well, let me finish my thought. Okay. So we've gone on these trips that kind of started – my parents did this all the time.
Yeah.
I grew up in Minnesota. We had relatives in California, and we'd drive across the country. And so I've tried to do that with my children, and we get in the car and we drive and we see, you know, Zion and Bryce Canyon. And we always set out with these very explicit things we want to see,
right,
places we want to go. And at the end of the day, when I look back on those, it's the experiences that I've had with my family that I take home. You know what I mean? It's like little stopping at a truck stop and – oh, I remember when Ellie got locked in the bathroom once at a Dairy Queen or something, you know. And so it's those little moments between us as people that end up being the real adventure, which is exactly the theme of the film.
Yeah.
So
it's precisely the theme of the film. It's the – I mean, Carl has this – he wants to – he feels like he's missed out on this adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But he really hasn't.
Yeah, and we tried to contrast that with the antagonist is named Charles Muntz,
yeah,
and he's voiced by Christopher Plummer, yeah, who's a fantastic, fantastic actor. It was a real joy to work with him and just watch how he approaches things. But he is kind of the opposite of Carl, who has gone to these fantastic ends of the earth, seen things no one has also seen, captured animals, and this all kind of takes place initially in the 30s and then flash forward to modern day. So.
Where did it start? I mean, and I wonder if it's typical. Does it start with a person? Is it a plot line? Is it an image? I mean, how do these ideas start? And how did Up start?
Well, there are no rules.
Yeah.
Toy Story was just kind of based on the idea of doing something with toys, because John Lasseter, who had directed the short film Tin Toy, and Joe Ranft, who is kind of our guru head of story, they had talked about doing something more, and we'd all worked on a television special as a kind of a stepping stone towards features.
Right.
And that didn't really go, so we said, well, let's make it into a feature, not really knowing anything about what we were getting into.
Right.
And so it was kind of grew out of that, just sort of general subject of toys are interesting. And I think we all shared that belief that somehow, when we left, the toys had their own life. You know, they all came to life and had conversations about us and everything.
Yeah,
monsters kind of came from that same idea that I just always knew that there were monsters hiding in my closet, waiting to scare me at night. And so then just started doing the thought exercise of, well, why? What are they doing back there? Why do they scare kids? What do they get out of it and all that?
Right.
This film was not quite that straightforward. It was a little more of, well, I think most animators are not extroverts. That's one of the reasons we draw, is because we need to express ourselves, but we are scared to talk to people in real life. So by the end of the day, I like to, you know, I'm exhausted. I'd rather hide under my desk. And so this was born out of that idea of getting away from everything. We drew Bob Peterson, who is he was basically the lead writer as well as co-director on this show. He and I just locked ourselves in a room and came up with this weird image of a house floating. And there was something really appealing about that. And then we, again, just kind of thought, who's in there?
Yeah.
How did they get there? Where are they going? And started to answer all these questions. So it just starts sometimes with a feeling or an image, a concept. There's all sorts of ways to get it going.
I want to play a scene, although that's odd to play a scene from an animated film on the radio.
Yeah.
But here's a scene from Up. Carl, as we've heard, he's a 78-year-old balloon salesman, widowed and withdrawn. And when we meet him, he just wants to be left alone. But then he happens upon Russell, an 8-year-old who is a junior wilderness explorer, Tribe 54, Lodge 12, and Russell needs one more badge to earn his rank, senior wilderness explorer, and that's what he's after when he finds Carl.
Let me tell you, if you order right now, you're going to get the...
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a wilderness explorer in Tribe 54, Sweat Lodge 12. Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard.
No.
I could help you cross your porch.
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a wilderness explorer in Tribe 54.
Slow down.
Sweat Lodge 12.
Kid!
Are you in need of any assistance today?
Thank you, but I don't need any help. Proceed.
Good afternoon.
Let's skip to the end.
See these? These are my wilderness explorer badges. You may notice one is missing. It's my assisting the elderly badge. If I get it, I will become a senior wilderness explorer. The wilderness must be explored!
Gah, gah!
Roar!
It's gonna be great. There's a big ceremony, and all the dads come, and they pin on our badges.
So, you want to assist an old person?
Yep. Then I'll be a senior wilderness explorer.
You ever heard of a snipe?
Snipe?
Bird. Beady eyes. Every night it sneaks in my yard and gobbles my poor azaleas. I'm elderly and infirm. I can't catch it. If only someone could help me.
Me! I'll do it!
Oh, I don't know. It's awfully crafty. You'd have to clap your hands three times to lure it in.
I'll find the Mr. Fredrickson.
I think its burrow's two blocks down.
If you two go blocks past- down, got it!
What's it like listening to that and not seeing it? Is that strange?
It is. I see it in my head.
Yeah, of course.
I should explain to people, in case it's not obvious, that the kid is reading out of a book. That's why he's repeating himself
and
so stiff at the beginning. But.
Tell us about Russell and finding Jordan, the actor.
Jordan Nagai.
Nagai.
Uh-huh.
Because he's not – this was his first experience in some ways.
Yeah, and kids – getting a kid to act, it's really rare that a child is willing to go to these extreme imaginative places. I mean, every kid wants to imagine to some degree, but most of them that we found are very extroverted, very
– they sound kind of canned.
Yeah, a little sort of Broadway and things like – so we were trying to get something very authentic.
Yeah.
And it was important that – to me, that we find somebody that you could really just believe is a real kid. So we hung up flyers in community centers and churches and just had open auditions. And I think the poor guys in development had to read something like 400 or 500 kids. And out of that, they pulled about 60 that I listened to. And one of them just – he was talking about judo lessons or something, just random. And just the quality of his voice was so entertaining to me that I thought, well, that if – he can make me laugh just talking about judo, then that's a good place to start, you know?
And you were looking for what? Something authentic. It had to seem like it was real.
Yeah, and something specific and interesting. It's a little bit like, you hear the story of Thumper, the voice of the little
rabbit in Bambi.
Bambi.
Yeah.
And the story was that they had this kid in and he was sort of stilted and odd, and the casting director said, no, get the kid out of here. And the animator said, no, wait. He sounds great. There's something just unique and specific and interesting about him. And I felt that with Jordan. There was a time when it didn't look like it was going to go.
Wow.
We'd recorded a couple different sessions with him. And what usually happens with not just him but any actor is that we start and we record them and we learn. We learn how they say things and what sounds truthful to them. And
is that inform the way you draw them too then?
To some degree. It's more usually by the time we cast the voice, we've already designed the character.
Sure.
So it exists almost, you know, think of a little puppet
yeah.
inside the computer. So now the animators take the voice. They listen to it. Some of them like to watch the performance by the actor. Others don't.
Huh.
Either way, they're informed by the read, by the performance, and then they create the movement, the expressions, the gestures. And so they're always reaching to try to connect those two. And so that's – in a lot of ways, the voice really does influence the – what you see on the screen in that way.
So you worried that it wasn't going to work with Jordan. What was the clincher? What made you think, I think it might work now? What happened?
Well, I think what happened was we just started embracing who he was as a kid. You know, we were trying to make him into this super hyped up, peppy, enthusiastic kid, which could work.
Sure.
But he in real life is a little more – he has a very sort of intellectual approach. He comes in and he kind of looks at things. And so we changed the character to suit him more, and that – kind of unlocked it for us.
There's kind of a lilt in his voice that seems a kind of a catch. There's something kind of
yeah.
something about it. I don't know, but it's yeah. it makes you laugh.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what attracted me about it.
Yeah. I'd read somewhere where you made Jordan I guess the question is, what's the trick to directing voice actors? And I had read somewhere where you made Jordan do these obstacle courses to
yeah.
get his energy level up.
Yeah. Sometimes the poor guy, I mean, he's such a smart kid, and we'd be doing, all right, take 52, you know, and,
right.
and he's so bored. And so we'd come up with ways to keep it interesting. And I'd actually, and this is something, you know, going back to Toy Story, I remember talking to Tom Hanks because his every delivery was so fresh, like he was just coming up with this right there and then.
Yeah.
And I just asked him, what's going through your head when you're acting? And he said, to be honest, as little as possible. And he's just trying to get a real instinctive gut thing. And so we kind of tried that with Jordan where, all right, I'm going to distract him. All right, run back over there around the chair three times clockwise. Then jump up and down, run around the foosball table and back up to the microphone. Ready, go. And so he'd do it and he'd be like, wait, how many times? Three times. Okay, go. And then by the time he came to the mic, he'd already knew the line because
yeah.
we'd done it 80
yeah.
times.
Yeah.
And then he would just launch into it, and it was much more energetic because he's very – you know, with most kids, they're very physical. And he was not thinking so much about it.
Mm.
So that seemed to work sometimes. Other times we'd have to do other things,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But he was a good sport.
But then you have Christopher Plummer and you have Ed Asner, veterans.
Clearly. I didn't have to get them to run around
no,
the
No, exactly.
The table,
so what did you want from them? I mean, what did you tell them to get, you know, what were you saying to them? What was the relationship like?
Well, with Plummer, basically I wanted to have a nice sit down and talk about the character and beforehand. And we came in and I said, well, do you have any thoughts? He said, nope, let's go. What, you mean record? Yeah, yeah. He'd read the whole script. He'd done his homework. He knew what he wanted to do.
Wow.
So he didn't really want to talk about it. He just wanted to do it. And I would make subtle adjustments of, you know, be more intimidating here I want you to really scare or trap Carl. Or you usually try to make it playable, like an effect that he's going to have on someone else. And he would adjust and do it again. And
he is scary.
He's great.
And he's really menacing it.
Yeah, he's great. So that was fun. And not a little intimidating.
Yeah.
I mean, we at one point we were recording with him, and he yelled or something, and he kind of backed off from the microphone like this. And the engineer said, Mr. Plummer, could you stay on mic? And he said, oh, that was a technique I learned from Orson Welles. Because he had worked with the guy,
sure.
you know. So, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. And, of course, working with Ed Asner yeah. was a complete joy. He was just a guy who – you know, we started out by just going out to dinner with them and talking, and we again tried to incorporate as many mannerisms of his natural, you know, persona into the character, and we just try different things and goof around and have a good time, and he'd give us a hard time, and
yeah.
oh, you again, you know,
yeah.
but you always had a sense at the end of the day we'd end and he would shake our hands and he'd just look us in the eye like thank you, and so he's so gracious and giving, so.
Yeah, so much of that character is blah and blah. It's
yeah.
just, it's all about the voice.
Yeah. Well, and that's why he worked so perfectly.
Yeah.
So.
They're not together, though. I mean, are they – or are they? Do you have them together? Do you do
only very infrequently do yeah. we record the actors together. In this film, none of them together. They were all separate, which is, again, part of the magic of the thing is you feel like these guys are there having an argument or
yeah.
rolling their eyes at
yeah.
each other, and it's all constructed, you know. out of little pieces. And this, the difference between something that's believable, like these characters are actually hearing each other and interacting, versus something that just sounds like dialogue cut together, very subtle, very subtle. And that's where, of course, the genius of editing comes in. And that's a hard thing to even talk about because it's a lot of just timing and the right take so that it sounds like he's actually hearing what the last guy said. And it's a lot of work.
Well, I'm neglecting phone calls. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. We'll take some calls when we get back from a break. Pete Docter is with us, writer and director of Pixar's latest film. It's called Up. It opens around the country on May 29th. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Pete Docter, who was a writer and director and with the Pixar Animation Studios. His latest film, which he directed, is called Up, opens around the country on May 29th. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Call from Bob. Bob, sorry for the wait. Bob's in Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Thank you, gentlemen. My question was this, is I've got five kids, and we've watched a lot of these movies throughout the years, but when Toy Story came out and Monsters, Inc., they had the short films on the DVDs a lot of the times, and I was just wondering if kind of a two-part question, is that kind of a launching pad for some of the feature movies that you have? And then, two, is there an archive of more of these short films? Because some of those are just so incredibly great.
Yeah, there are. There's a DVD you can get of the Pixar Shorts. I don't remember what it's called, probably just Pixar Shorts.
Yeah.
And it's a collection of all the short films from the very early days, which are really what led to the formation of Toy Story and Monsters and a lot of the other films, was those short films. And then now we use them. Initially, we were using them more to test technology. And nowadays, we use them almost more to test people. So as a new – somebody's coming up and we think, oh, that person would be a good director. Let's try them out on a short film and test their chops. So,
Bob, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is that number, 801-585-9378. Let me read an email. This comes from Wade. Wade writes – Wade's in Ogden. He said he wants to say that WALL-E has become one of his favorite movies of all time. He writes, the social commentary on business excess coupled with the ultimate consequences of convenience on human laziness is stellar. Each time I watch the movie, he writes, I'm also fascinated by the care that went into the mechanical design of all the robots. Is there a team of engineers, he writes, involved in the animation and design phase?
Yes, actually. Not so much – well – yeah, there's computer engineers and a lot of the artists who designed those characters could be designing cars. I mean, these guys really understand mechanics and interrelation. And, of course, there's a lot of cheating that goes on, too. It's a really unique talent to be able to make something like that look like it works but do the more important job of emotionally connecting and fulfilling the role that it has to, you know, play on the screen. So I'm glad that glad that he liked it.
Yeah. Wade, thanks very much. I wanted to ask you about the voice of Ellie, which is – it's your daughter.
Yeah,
is that
is.
Right? Now, she played Boo in Monsters. Is that right?
No, that was somebody else's daughter.
Oh, it was. Okay.
So we do this all kind of for convenience, and the thought is it's just going to be temp.
Yeah, it's like a scratch track.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Temporary track.
So, like with this one, we knew that if one of us tried to do the voice, it would just sound horrible. It'd be so distracting that you'd never get whether the story's working or not. So my daughter came in. We just kind of worked her and did voice work, and then she worked out so well that it stayed. So
I mean, worked out so well. It's such a great voice, and is she an actor?
No. No, she loves MGM musicals and old Disney things, and so she was kind of aping Moochie, you know, the character from the 70s, 60s Disney shows.
So, oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's this device you use in Up, And it's this montage of – it's kind of like like there was one in Citizen Kane where it's this montage where life is progressing for Carl and mm-hmm. Ellie. They get married. They fall in love. They get married. And I'm not sure. It's just a few minutes where we go through their lives. What's the art there? Because you have to portray so much. It has to – there's so much exposition. You have to really lay out because we have to end up caring about him.
Right.
In a short amount of time. What's the trick there?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. That's probably my favorite part of the film.
Huh.
It's probably a lot like writing a term paper or anything else where you start with way too much and you pare down just to the bare essentials. That was the same with that. We had a bunch of little scenes with dialogue and effects and everything.
Oh, with dialogue?
Yeah, initially. And the first pitch of it was great and worked totally. It brought people to tears and everything, but it was way too long and we just kept stripping down and eventually we got rid of dialogue and eventually we even got rid of sound effects. And so it's just music with these pictures. And some of that is – I grew up my parents took a lot of Super 8 films of us growing up, which you watch now and there's no sound. So it's just the projector, you know. And there's something really emotional about that. And we're trying to kind of capitalize on that by not putting sound effects in – dialogue in, my thought is anyway, that you're inviting the audience to kind of participate a little bit more, you know, that they're bringing their own thought to what are the characters talking about or what are they laughing at or it sort of comes to life in their own head.
Hmm.
At least that's my armchair philosophy of it.
Well, I had mentioned Orson Welles, but I think I also read that Frank Capra helped inspire the part of that. Is that right?
Yeah. His films are so great and they have this wonderful sort of warmth to them and the great rich characters. And we were trying to kind of reach back to some of the Capra films as well as the great Disney films that I grew up on, Lady and the Tramp and 101 Dalmatians, all these, again, just rich, great characters and a little simpler story. I don't know if we succeeded in that regard or not, but, that was the attempt.
Mm. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Nate is with us in Sandy, Utah. Nate, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm wondering if a movie takes so long to make 5 years I'm wondering if the technology changes over that time and if that actually shows up in the animation or the resolution or anything like that, the technical.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. And at some point, technology changes so fast, we have to kind of commit. At some point, you kind of pull a lever and say, all right, we're using this version of the software. We're not going to keep updating or we'll break everything that's been done, you know. And that happens on every film. We try to do advanced planning, as we're starting it. Say, okay, what are the real things that we're going to need for this film, like water, for example, on Nemo, or fur for monsters.
Yeah.
What are those things that we're going to need for this film? We do a bunch of R&D. We try to get a really robust system, and then we go into production. And at that point, we say, all right, no matter how many things advance and get better, we're going to stick to what we have here just in order to finish the film. And then the next film, we go to the next system. So,
how much is how is the technology changing in terms of the way these things look and the way you tell – I mean the story is basic, right? It almost seems like the technology doesn't matter for the storytelling.
True.
But how does the technology influence and how is it changing, do you think?
Well, starting with Toy Story, there were certain things we just couldn't do. We had one scene I remember where Woody has just been burned with a magnifying glass and he's got this spot on his head. And as soon as Sid leaves, he goes, and he ducks his head into a – we had initially had a bowl of water and there was a big splash.
Right.
And we showed it to the technical directors and they sort of blanched, And, and so we said, all right, let's see. We don't want to spend a lot of time on this. We could do a ton of work to try to do a splash, but we just filled it with donuts, little tiny donuts, and it looked like Fruit Loops cereal, old bowl of cereal. And you get the same story point without having to have a big splash. So there's a lot of stuff like that, especially early on, that we not necessarily compromised, but it kind of creatively limited us. And we had to go a different direction just to avoid spending a lot of work on things. Nowadays, almost anything is possible. It's just a matter of how much time you want to spend on it.
Mm-hmm.
So if something is clearly a featured element. Like in this film, we have 10,000 balloons that this house is floated into the air, and they all bump into each other and they all interact with
squeaking
wind.
And making noise.
Yeah. So we needed that to work. So we spent a lot of time doing that. If there's some little throwaway thing that's just in one shot, then maybe we'll find a way to shoot around it or do something else, you know.
Going back to that idea of caricature for Carl and the characters, and I'm thinking about, you know, like I see age spots on his mm-hmm. on his hands,
mm-hmm.
yet he has no nostrils.
Right.
You know, he has no ear holes, I don't
right.
think.
No.
So it's
although
all,
he does have a hearing aid.
Although he does
have
yeah. Yeah, it's all about, I guess, but as long as we care about him and we believe it, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah. And you know, there are some things about every person, no matter how young or old they are, that are kind of unappealing when you get too close, you know,
yeah,
his skin
yeah.
pores and things. And so we're trying to kind of reduce that stuff out and yet still get him to read as an old man. So you get these age spots. And even there, we tried to caricature them. They're kind of more squared off than
yeah.
real ones. So, yeah, it's fun.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Nate, thanks very much. Daryl is with us also in Sandy. Daryl, hi.
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 How's it going?
Good.
I first want to say thanks for the Pixar movies. I think you've set such a high level of excellence.
Oh, thanks.
I love them.
That's good to hear.
Thank you. My question is, in WALL-E, you decided to use Fred Willard, you know, whereas most of your other characters are animated. I was wondering
right.
what went into that decision.
Well, that was and I can't really take credit or blame for that because that came along after I was affiliated with the project. But Andrew Sott was – once he sort of came up with the conceit of Hello, Dolly, which is the live-action yeah. movie that you needed to create the rest of the world that would support that. And so it made sense to have a live human who would represent – you know, in the same way those were live humans in that movie. So – that was the thinking.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit off air about that, about the Hello Dolly part of that. You say that was that wasn't in the original concept, and it seems like such a central part of WALL-E and that emotion. How did it come about?
Well, I mean, with a lot of these things, they feel it's the great illusion, right? That
yeah.
you feel as though they all came fully formed out of someone's head, and they're just there on the screen. That's a complete that's not at all the case.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of work, and there's a lot of kind of just ticky-tack ends that you have to fit together. And, you know, one of the criticisms on this film early on was that it felt too much like a laundry list of things that I liked. Hmm. And we worked really hard to connect them and make them all integral. Like, if you're going to have a bird, it has to come up in the story in some way. You know, they're all connected. All the elements kind of fit together in some way. I think that's just what you want from a good story.
But I also think you've said that at some point, all of the Pixar films, despite being remarkably successful, they're all a disaster at some point.
Oh yeah, awful.
Really?
Unwatchable.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a couple of my own movies I've wanted to walk out on, you know. But the cool thing is we allow ourselves to take that risk, you
yeah.
know. If we had to do the safe thing, we'd probably be more successful right out of the shoot. But in the long run, I think the movies would be kind of more similar and more mm. predictable.
Mm.
And so we allow ourselves that we just know they're going to be bad for a while, but we're going to make them better. And that's what happens.
Was there a moment in Up, for example, a particular problem that you were trying to work through and trying to work through and trying to work through? Can you say about one particular problem that you had to work through? I mean, I'm sure there are a number.
There are a lot of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think now. Well, one of them was just why Carl ended up where he was. Well, let's see. That's not really a great example. I should come back to that because something will occur
okay.
to me.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask about the colors, and we talked a little bit about angles, and it seems like Russell is round where Carl is angular. But I
yeah.
was thinking about the colors too because there's this bird, this wooden bird, I think, on his mantle,
mm-hmm.
which seems so much more colorful and so much pops out. I mean, how important is the idea of color in giving us a sense of the story?
Well, there again, we tried to use color as an extension of the characters and the heart of the story.
Yeah.
So Ellie is this vibrant, wild personality who really brings color into Carl's life. And when she dies, there's one scene where he walks into the house and you just see the last vestige of color fading off as though the sun is setting.
Yeah.
And everything from then on is more desaturated and black and white, and not literally, but, you know, gray,
sure,
browns. So, you know, anything we can to plus the emphasis in the story and the emotion, that's what we're trying to do. Russell, he's more – he's like a reincarnation of Ellie in a way, since
yeah,
she, you know, you sort of lose her in the beginning, but we really feel her presence and her – she – it's because of her that Carl is trying to do what he's trying to do. So she's really the drive behind the whole movie.
What do you want when people leave the theaters, they're walking out, what is it you want them to be thinking about? What is it that you want them to be feeling, I guess? Is it always different?
Well, on this one, I tell you, it was the first time we had the whole thing up on reels, and weirdly, it played all right. It played – I mean, there were tons of broken things, but you could see the heart of it.
Yeah.
And the producer, Jonas Rivera, said, Pete, that was great. I just want to go home and be with my wife and kids. And I was like, wow, that's really cool, because that's exactly what we're trying to say, is that you think of all these things, and not to say dreams are bad and hopes are stupid or anything, because everybody has these great hopes and dreams of travel and adventure and even things like, say, owning a restaurant or what. But I think often we don't really appreciate what we actually have until it's gone. And so if this film can kind of do that to some degree, then that's what we're aiming for.
Pete Docter, he was written and directed Up, which opens nationwide May 29th. Pete Docter, thanks very much for the time.
That's it? We're done?
We're done.
Oh, that was fun.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.